the level of detail that we applied to certain passages of the book of Joel. But hopefully we might be able to return to some of the more finer details in subsequent weeks. Now, the book of Esther has not had a smooth journey into the passages, the pages of the Bible. Very early on, it was a source of embarrassment for many theologians and rabbis, and even some 16th century reformers had their reservations about the book. And one of the biggest reasons why it was treated with such caution was that it lacks any reference to God. Now, you probably know that, I'm sure you do. It's become a bit of a well-known piece of Bible trivia that the book of Esther doesn't refer to God explicitly. But you probably didn't know that the translators of the 3rd century BC text, the Greek Septuagint, of the translation of the Old Testament into the Greek, those translators were so uncomfortable about the absence of God from this book that they actually inserted prayers and proclamations about God into the mouths of the book's characters. You see, the problem was for them that it just seemed so unnatural that a book which was inspired by God would not at least mention God. And this just struck them as profoundly unspiritual. And this problem then, it's led many people, including many Christians down through the ages, to even start to question whether the book of Esther belonged in the Bible at all. And I wonder then whether this truth about the book of Esther maybe leaves you feeling a little bit uncomfortable as well. You might ask, well, what exactly is it then which makes this book, the book of Esther, any different to any other ancient storybook? Well, I want to put to you a rather strange proposition this morning, and it's this. I want to suggest that the fact that this book of Esther doesn't mention God explicitly should not be a source of discomfort for us, but actually a source of comfort. Now, maybe you think that's a bit controversial. Well, let me go even further than that. Let me say, I think we should be thankful to God that God's name doesn't feature explicitly in this book. Thankful that the writer at no point feels the need to use one of those many Hebrew names for God. Now, why do I say that? Well, here's what I'm getting at. The book of Esther helpfully reassures us that it's completely normal for ordinary life not to come with a sort of background commentary on God's purposes and plans. You see, often in the Old Testament, we will be given a direct window onto the counsel of God. We're told why this event or that event takes place. On occasions, God even steps down directly into the narrative and engages on a one-to-one level, maybe in the form of a burning bush, maybe in the form of an angel. He engages with his people. That happens in the Old Testament. But the book of Esther reminds us that for most people in Israel, and for most people we meet in the pages of the Bible, this was not a common experience. It's very easy to forget that their lives were very much like ours most of the time. Things happened to them, sometimes good things, sometimes bad things, but why God allowed these things to happen to them would often remain a mystery, often until the end of their lives. You see, just like our lives, their lives felt like a chain of undiscernible, irrational events without reason, without logic, and very often a million miles away from anything which felt supernatural. And so the book of Esther brings us down to that human, ordinary level. We watch events unfold in all their chaos and randomness, and we watch them do that through the eyes of the little people who are caught up in them. We're not suddenly told why God did this thing or that thing. We're not suddenly told that God approved of this thing or disapproved of this thing. No, because the book of Esther, the God of the book of Esther, is not one who intervenes here and there and then just lets history haphazardly take its course. No, that's not the God we find in the book of Esther. And yet that doesn't mean he's absent from the book. On the contrary, the author of this book is not intending to exclude God from history. Rather, and this is the important thing, he's encouraging us to see that the workings of God oversee every single event which take place in history. It's not just that God interrupts here and there, does a miracle here, does a miracle there. No, God is invisibly presiding over every single little detail of the story. You see, as we consider the rest of this book in future weeks, and as we see the story of Esther unfold, we start to realize that this is not just random events, that the significance of this story for Israel and for the coming Messiah, the significance of this story means that it has to have taken place as part of God's plan for his people. We are inescapably drawn towards the fact that the whole of this book is driven by the invisible purposes of God. And so in this sense, then, the book encourages us to look above itself, or rather to read between the lines and to see the invisible hand of God, the divine perspective presiding over the natural cause and effect of history. Well, I hope I've made that clear enough. And this morning, then, I just want us to look at two ways in which the book in these early chapters suggests the divine perspective which oversees the natural unfolding of history. And the first is that we see a divine perspective of earthly power. A divine perspective of earthly power. You see, from the very beginning of the book of Esther, we're treated to this almost cinematic entrance. Look at verse 1 of chapter 1. We're given this sort of aerial shot of this kingdom, India, Ethiopia, 127 provinces encompassing hundreds of cultures and languages. It's of epic proportions. And then in verse 2, we zoom down into this capital city of Susa, and then into the very gardens of King Ahasuerus himself, and we are immersed in colours and textures and flavours, and we hear the sounds of the musical instruments playing, and we almost sense the celebration of the crowds, and we're taken bit by bit through the exquisite details. Look at verse 6. White cotton, violet hangings, fine linen and purple, silver rods, gold couches, marble pillars, mosaic pavements, and all of the precious stones that make them up. And then we get to taste the royal wine in the individualized golden goblets. Why are we given such a cinematic introduction? Well, we're told in verse 4 that the king was flaunting his royal glory, his pomp, and his greatness. And you see, the thing is, it's almost as if the narrative cooperates with him in this. Not only are we told that the flaunting goes on for 180 days, followed by a seven-day feast, but the passage actually itself seems to speak so extensively in its description of the affair. It just feels so prolonged, doesn't it? It's lavish. It lays it on thick. We get this sense of liberality and richness. Each man could have as he desired, it tells us in verse 8. The narrative is cooperating with us in this sense of power and pomp and glory. And then we get this sort of sense of foreignness as well, don't we? We're sort of immersed in this sense of foreignness, difference. So who exactly is in this crowd of people we're dealing with? Well, verse 3 tells us that there are officials and servants, nobles and governors. But it's not just that the civil service are there, which they are there, but in verse 5 we're told that amongst these crowds are all the people of Susa, great and small. So we're immediately immersed in this mixed, buzzing crowd of people drawn out from across the empire, this kind of multicultural hub. We're given these long lists of exotic sounding names, like the eunuchs in verse 10, you know, people like Mahuman and Bizthar and Harbona and Bigthar and Abagthar and Zithar and Carcass, the seven eunuchs. Or in verse 14, the wise men, Again, sort of foreign sounding names like Karshena and Shethar and Admatha and Tarshish and Meres and Marsena and Memucan. So the book is deliberately trying to get us to sense this lavish display of the king's glory and this just sense of foreignness. We feel like we're in a different culture. We feel like we're in a different world. And it would have felt very much like that for the first Jewish readers of this book, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, they're Jews, and this isn't Israel. This is someplace else. This is Susa, and this is a place of difference, and it's unusual, and it's foreign, and it's intimidating in a sense. The passage almost gives the Jewish reader a kind of mini culture shock as they're immersed in all this foreign and disorientating material. Now, what's the effect of that on the narrative? Well, the effect of that on the narrative is that we are led to sense the smallness of God's people compared to this big, strange world in which they're living. So consider for a second the fact, consider these people, Mordecai and Esther. It takes a long time before they arrive, doesn't it, in the narrative. It's chapter 2, verse 5. And notice just how comparably short their introduction is. And then just consider this girl Esther for a second. I mean, she's a female. She's an orphan. She wouldn't have any sort of supportive family around her. Verse 7 tells her that her mother and father had died. She's part of this displaced people, these Jews who are hundreds of miles away from their homeland. So she's an exiled ethnic minority. And it's probably worth saying also that at this point of history, most of her fellow Jews would have already gone back to Israel again. They would have returned to the land of Israel under the reign of King Cyrus. So she's actually a bit of an outlier remaining in Susa at this time. She's even more distinct in that respect. And how then would it have felt for them to have been in this place at this time? Well, you get the sense in which this culture is just, it's just so different to them, to what they're all about. And in fact, it would have been very hostile to them, wouldn't it? I mean, in the first, not very long after the chapters we read later on, the next chapter, we read of how the villain of this story, who we'll come to in later sermons, he uses their culture as a sort of weapon against the Jews. It'll be argued, probably falsely, that the Jews, they have different laws to the Persians and that they don't keep the laws of the king. And so we get the sense then that they must have been on the receiving end of much racism and misrepresentation. Often sort of the word privilege has become a bit of a buzzword among young liberal-minded people today. They explain that certain people in society have privilege over others. And really they just mean social status. And you can sort of make your own mind up about some of their thoughts about things. But my point is this, that even by the standards of today's liberal thinkers, Esther and Mordecai, they definitely didn't have privilege in this world they were living in. They would have been one of the least privileged people in the city of Susa at that time. Esther did not have privilege. Indeed, the only positive comment we receive about these people actually strikes us as very superficial, doesn't it? I mean, we're told in verse 7 that Esther is physically attractive. And you sort of think, well, that's kind of nice, but what good was that for her in the long run? What did that count for in the grand scheme of things? One would expect very little at all at the end of the day. It's a very superficial thing. She's pretty. That's it. That's the one redeeming feature she has in this story. She's pretty. And then the description of Mordecai and Esther is over again in the space of three verses, and we're back to the plot again. And so the overall impression that we're being given here is this. We're being told to witness the scale of this contrast, this orphan cousin placed next to the most powerful man in the whole world, this King Ahasuerus, perched on the top of the most powerful and extensive foreign empire in the whole world. It's very intimidating, isn't it? This kingdom of the Persians is very established, and it must have been so psychologically threatening for the Jews at that time to think, you know, what was the kingdom of Israel compared to this kingdom? Indeed, what was God, the God of Israel, compared to this kingdom? It really made him feel very puny indeed. How could the God of Israel stand up in the face of this great alternative system? The narrative, then, it wants you to feel this sense of disturbance. It wants you to feel out of sync with what's going on. It wants you to feel small in the midst of this big empire. Which is why I think the narrative doesn't continue that note. On the one hand, we are shown the scale of the contrast. But on the other hand, the narrative supplies us with, even at the very beginning of this story, a little bit of the divine perspective of things. What I mean is that we're provided, even in these very early chapters, with little reminders that ultimately supreme power does not lie in the hands of any world empire or any grand pompous king, but in the hands of a higher throne. I mean, for one thing, notice just how fundamentally limited this king, King Ahasuerus, is actually shown to be. It's not very long until we discover that his power is not quite as gripping as you first might imagine. It's not that we find his power becomes totally undermined in this story, but we are reminded, aren't we, in these passages of ours, that powerful oppressors, powerful kings, are not as unquestionably great as they might want to imagine. And what I'm referring to here is that little episode with Queen Vashti, which takes place from chapter 1 and verse 12 onwards. What happens? Well, the king wants to bring out his wife, Queen Vashti, and he wants to show her beauty to his friends, basically, to the princes. And whatever her husband might think, Queen Vashti's not overly keen on this idea, is she? She's not all that keen to parade her beauty in front of a group of her husband's maids. And so she refuses. She puts her foot down. And this is a terrible disappointment to the king. And more than that, it is an enormous undermining of his self-belief. You see, this is the king who supposedly can command millions upon millions of people to do his bidding. He can get whatever he wants, whenever he wants. He can command a 180-day festivities. He can have a 7-day feast. And yet he can't even summon his own wife. And this fiasco, then, it lasts for quite a while. It lasts at least till chapter 2. And Queen Vashti, what does she do? Well, she sort of throws cold water over all these festivities, over this 180-day exhibition of power. And what I want to suggest, then, is that this ought to be seen as a little sort of divine blessing for us in the text. You see, God allows a fresh draft of realism to come breezing through this passage. A little bit of the wallpaper of King Ahasuerus is peeled away, and you see that the plaster behind is actually cracked. His assumed authority is not quite as impressive as you once thought it was. He is cut down to size. See, even in the midst of all this pomp and ceremony, the invisible God reminds us that man is not the boss he might think he is. Ahasuerus's power is finite and measurable. Indeed, man's power will always be finite and measurable. And that then is a huge encouragement for us today, isn't it? Because, well, what do we fear in life living in this 21st century of ours? Well, often we fear that which is powerful, don't we? That which is grand and foreign and belittling. Very often we are intimidated by the power of the government, or intimidated by the power of supposed intellectuals and experts who tell us that the Bible is just a load of old stories with no relevance to the present day at all. Or we're intimidated by our friend who seems to have it all sorted and seems to be so clever and so switched on and knows about everything, and yet he has no time for your God. He has no time for the Bible. That's all below him. We're intimidated by that, aren't we? And we're intimidated at times by just how much this godless society of ours can seem so established and so functional. It just seems to work, doesn't it? The alternative philosophies of the world, they just seem to get by unquestioned. How does that happen? And at times, even today in this country, the UK, we can feel very much like foreigners, like Esther and Mordecai, living in the midst of this very foreign world. And I want to remind you that that hasn't been an unusual feeling for Christians throughout the history of the world. I mean, think of what it meant for Martin Luther to attack the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church, it was this established, unquestionable system. It held all power and all truth. How could you question that? And here's this little man, Martin Luther, stood in the face of this grand alternative system, and yet he knows that they've misunderstood his God and his gospel. Or you think of what it must have been like for the many missionaries of the 19th and 18th centuries, you know, arriving on the shores of India or Africa or China, and just seeing this vast world in which there is no gospel light, it seems. It just seems so established, so unquestionable. How could it be that this puny missionary with this little bit of gospel truth he's clinging to could change this nation, could stand in the face of this alternative system? Well, allow the narrative to remind you this morning that all that seems so powerful and established in this world isn't quite as powerful as we might first think. If God can use an unruly wife to undermine the most powerful king in the world, then surely he can totally obliterate the powers around us. He can bring them down. And that should melt our fears. That should remind us that ultimately it's our king who is boss. He is our God. He is the one who's in control of everything. So the narrative gives us that divine perspective on power and the divine perspective on earthly power. But secondly, I want to suggest that the narrative gives us a divine perspective on chaos and sin, a divine perspective on chaos and sin. Now, I said that these chapters that we're dealing with this morning, they're really only setting the scene. We're not really moving into the details of the plot yet. We're just being introduced to the main characters. And the character which definitely gets the most attention in these chapters, these first two chapters, is of course the character of Ahasuerus. Now, there are some characters in the Bible who remain strange and mysterious and enigmatic for a long time. So you think of the patriarchs, and you think of men like Jacob or maybe Joseph, and even some of the commentators disagree, don't they, about, well, was Joseph right to do this? Was he wrong to do that? What do we think? He's a bit mysterious. Well, King Ahasuerus isn't mysterious in that same way, is he? Because before we're even in chapter 2, the picture of this man is very straightforward, isn't it? I mean, for one thing, he's a pompous man, and that doesn't really require any further elaboration. Just notice the fact that we're not given any justification for his exhibition of power. We're just told that it was an exhibition of power, an exhibition of one man's riches and greatness. But also he's a drinker. Verse 10 tells us that on the seventh day, the king was merry with wine. Now you might think that the king had some excuses to be drunk on this occasion. You know, it's huge, these festivities going on, but it's not the only instance we get of the king's drinking in this book. And we'll return to that characteristic later in this book. His policies are driven by animal instincts. Verse 11, what's the reason he wants to bring Queen Vashti out? Well, it's in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty. So he clearly sees it as the height of achievement to have obtained this trophy. in Vashti. Then again, he is easily provoked. In verse 12, it says that the king becomes enraged and his anger burns within him. And it really is such a petty matter that he's become angry at, the fact that Vashti has refused to come up. It could have been handled so much more nobly, couldn't it, from the king? But he doesn't rein in his temper. No, rather, he just allows his anger to blow up freely. He's an impulsive man. What's his procedure following this refusal of Vashti to come? Well, in verse 13, he summons his wise men to deal with this situation, and he asks in verse 15, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus? And you think, really? That's how he sees fit to deal with his nearest and dearest, to slap down the law because she wasn't willing to publicly expose herself like that. That's what he feels like the law is for, to bring it down on his wife because she didn't want to come and appear before her, his friends. And at the end of the day, he's a pushover, isn't he? He's just far too easily convinced by the advice of his nobles, his advisors. I mean, they reached the most far-fetched conclusions about what might happen. Verse 17, they get the king anxious about the possibility of some kind of radical feminist revolution off the back of what's happened in the king's palace. And to remedy that sort of hypothesized feminist revolution, they come up with the most bizarre and unenforceable plan. I mean, look at verse 21. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and every people in its own language, that every man be the master of his own household and speak according to the language of his people. You think, really, that was the plan which pleased the king, to enforce that every man be master of his household. I mean, surely that kind of proposal would have come across as the most pointless and patronizing thing that the men of the land had ever heard. I mean, surely if the women of the empire were feeling mistreated, it's that kind of decree which would only anger them any even further than they were already angry. I mean, what kind of man was the king to so highly regard this kind of whimsical policymaking? And then you see his animal instincts just continue as we get into chapter 2. Notice what we said a moment ago about his prizing of Vashti's beauty. Well, here those instincts of his come to the fore again. Look at how much description, for instance, the narrator puts into the harem. This process of finding a replacement wife. It consumes the whole of the chapter, this whole ordeal. And you read it and you think, why is all of this detail so important? And yet that's sort of the point, isn't it? The very fact that this passage is so long reminds us that this is a man, King Ahasuerus, who has his priorities backwards. And then just look how this process of beautifying is described in verse 12 of chapter 2. It says, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments. This was the regular period of their beautifying, 12 months. Now, maybe you think I'm making a bit of a mountain out of a molehill by drawing our attention to that. I mean, you're thinking, well, this is ancient Persia after all. Maybe that was a common practice, that level of beautifying. Well, maybe, but, you know, it's actually one of the reasons why the historians are not willing to believe that the Book of Esther is historically reliable. One of the reasons they argue is because they think that 12-month period of beautifying is just so far-fetched. They can't believe it. Why would a king spend that long trying to beautify his virgins, his concubines? And then when you finally remember the purpose of this whole endeavor to get hold of a new queen, you realize just how absurd all of this is. I mean, think about this. This man is trying to find a wife to replace Vashti. He's looking for someone who will not do what Vashti has just done. Someone who will not be defying her husband in public anytime soon. And at the end of the day, what was it which made Vashti such a poor choice for the king in the first place? Well, it was because by having Vashti as a wife, the king had prioritized beauty over character. He had been so enamored by her sex appeal that he hadn't given a moment's thought to this woman's attitude. He misjudged her, and it ended up in a huge embarrassment for the king in public. And you think then, wouldn't you, in the light of such a monumental disaster, the king would have learnt some sense. I mean, surely the worst thing he can do now is base his choice for a new wife on something so flimsy as appearance. Surely he'd be after someone who was reliable and who wouldn't embarrass the king in public. But what is the advice of his excellent counsellors? Verse 3, let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem. And at the end of the verse, let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. So even after this alleged national crisis because of Vashti's bad behavior, the king is still putting cosmetics on the top of the list in finding a replacement queen. And of course, when we get to the end of chapter 2, we see all it takes for the king to be convinced that Esther is the queen he wants. What does it take? It takes a night in the bedroom to win him over. A night in the bedroom, and Esther is made queen of Persia. So what am I trying to get at here? What are the effects of this man, King Ahasuerus, on the plot? Well, on the one hand, I think we're supposed to find the whole thing rather amusing. I mean, this man and his supposedly wise counselors are made a mockery of in these chapters. They're so powerful, and yet they're so stupid, and that should bring a smile to our faces. But on the other hand, there is a much darker side to all this. You see, it wouldn't have been very funny for Esther and Mordecai living under this kind of rule. You see, this wasn't just an impulsive drunk man. This was an impulsive drunk man in charge of 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. The point is that Persia is not a very stable place to be in right now. Even after Esther's exaltation, the Jews are living under conditions of severe instability. The future is very, very uncertain. And again, it leads us to think about our own times, doesn't it? We live in an age which at times feels very uncertain. We're worried about the effect of this pandemic on the future, on our economic future, on what the restrictions might mean long term. Things are uncertain in that regard. Or perhaps we talk and worry about the prospects of Brexit. What will the results be of that? It just seems so confusing for us to get our heads around. Will it be so good? Will they be so bad? What will the effects be? They're so unpredictable. We think of international affairs and what goes on in America and what goes on in China and what goes on in Russia and North Korea. And we think, how do we read all of this stuff? It just seems so chaotic. You think of how Donald Trump was the kind of man who, you know, under the slightest little provocation would result in an angry tweet written in capital letters so the whole world could see. That was the level of impulsiveness we saw from that man. And we don't want to minimalize any of this unpredictability right now, but I do want us to remember that Esther's day was quite different even to our day. I mean, that was a day when a haphazard legal decree could be issued instantly with colossal nationwide implications. This was a day when the slightest provocation didn't result in an angry tweet from Mr. Trump across the pond. Rather, it could result in death, and not just one death, but many, many deaths, the deaths of potentially thousands. And indeed, the whole story of Esther revolves around one such decree, which threatens that. So here we see Esther and Mordecai, and they're up against this great chaos, and they're up against this sin, not just the sin of the king, not just the pride and the lust and the family discordance that he has, but they were immersed in a sin-infested culture, a culture which was pervaded with sin. The ways of God would have felt very different from the ways of Susa. The idol worship would have been inescapable. The Sabbath would have been routinely defiled. And the law of Israel would have struck most as an irrelevant legal code of a basically extinct group of people. But my point this morning is that this is not a sermon about mere unpredictability and chaos and sin. Rather, my point this morning is that this chaos and sin are not in the driving seat of our passage. You see, while chaos and sin do look like for a time that they're in the driving seat of this passage, we already have hints, even from the very beginning of this book, that that is far from the case. Indeed, and this is important, that chaos and sin are actually the very instruments of the one who is in the driving seat. I just wanted to draw your attention finally then, as we wrap up, to two incidents in our passage which remind us that chaos and sin are not in the driving seat. Look at the passage which concludes our chapter, chapter 2, verses 9 to 23. And there in that passage, we see this pathetic looking man, Mordecai, this Jew. He's anxious about his cousin Esther. He's culturally embarrassed. I mean, this is the man who we're told in the chapter has hidden the fact that he's Jewish from the king. So he's embarrassed about his culture. He just seems all very puny, doesn't he? And then what appears completely accidental, he overhears this conversation. He overhears this conversation by two of these eunuchs in verse 21, Bigthan and Teresh. And he overhears them plotting to kill the king. And at first glance, that just seems like a completely incidental detail. It seems like, well, he's just sort of just part of the chaos, isn't it? It's just part of the randomness of life. He just happened to be standing in that right place at that right time, and he overheard that conversation. And yet the reality is that as we read this book, we'll discover that that event was no incidental detail. That was not a little bit of randomness. No, rather, that was an event which would put Mordecai in the history books. Indeed, the whole plot will revolve around that tiny little incidental detail of Mordecai overhearing that plot. He alerts Esther, Esther alerts the king, and Mordecai finds his names in the history books, and we come back to that detail later on. But it's just a reminder, isn't it, that even though everything at this point still seems so chaotic, through the randomness of life, God is working. It's not enough to say that this is a coincidental event, rather it's crucial to God's plans for his people. And then finally, just this incident regarding Esther. I mean, Esther, she again goes from this position of being so insignificant in the hands of this chaotic, impulsive, lustful king. And yet what happens? Well, it's those chaotic, impulsive, lustful desires of his which actually find Esther winds up in the palace. She winds up with a crown on her head. In only a few verses, this girl goes from being an orphan to being a queen. Chaos and sin are the very things used by the invisible God to put a crown on Esther's head. This situation of powerlessness is reversed beyond all rational expectation. And what is the way in which she finds herself in this position? Well, it's her beauty, isn't it? It's that detail which we said before, which just seems so insignificant, so pointless. It's just a shallow thing, her beauty. And yet, even in that little insignificant, unexpected feature, that becomes the vehicle to bring about God's purposes. So, what do we find in our passage? We find lust, we find impulsiveness, we find marital breakdown, we find bad advice, we find cultural awkwardness, we find a whole host of insignificant, seemingly random, chaotic details, and yet we're given the hint that even in these early stages, all of this is being harnessed by God. And where is it taking us to? Well, at the end of this book, we will reach a point of grand exaltation of God's people and the grand justice judgment of his enemies. That is how God is using the chaos of this book. As I said, this is a good book for us to read in these days, isn't it? The world can often feel very chaotic and very disorderly and unpredictable. And as Christians, we find ourselves in the face of world powers which are very intimidating and we don't know how to deal with. We think, how can our God stand up to these great forces? And it's very easy, isn't it, to drink in atheistic beliefs about the world, materialism. We just sort of think we're prone to just see the world as a chaos of atoms. It's just a dog-eat-dog evolutionary world which doesn't have any ultimate meaning to it. And, you know, people who are Christians will share those sentiments too and share that uncertainty too as they look around and they think to themselves, how do we cope in a world which seems so meaningless and chaotic? And perhaps they might develop certain coping strategies to deal with that. They say things like, well, we just must embrace the purposelessness of life, or we should invent our own meaning, or we can choose how to interpret the world. You decide what your life is all about. Don't let anyone stop you. And there's a sort of appealing nature to that mentality, isn't there? But at the end of the day, that kind of coping strategy in this chaotic world is really very shallow. It holds no weight. I mean, what meaning do you invent for yourself when tragedy strikes, or when you're on your deathbed, or when you discover that your husband or wife of many years has been unfaithful to you, or when you yourself get caught up in personal sin, or your popularity, your renown is completely thrown down the pan? How do you deal with that level of chaos and unpredictability in this world? Well, the beautiful thing about the book of Esther is that we're told here that we don't get to invent our own meaning, our own interpretation of the world. Yes, the world can seem very chaotic and very dark and foreign, and powerful forces hold sway. But ultimately, even these things are the instruments of God. They're used to bring about his purpose. They have meaning in his story for the world. It can be tempting to think, can't it, when we're in the face of difficulty, that surely God can just intervene. He can do a miracle here and there. He can interrupt and do something really amazing and special and something I can trust in. The thing is, the book of Esther reminds us that that's not how God usually chooses to work. You know, Esther and Mordecai would have been very tempted to think that way, to want a miraculous intervention. But rather, we should adopt the view that God uses every little detail of this whole world to bring about his purposes. Whether it's a decision made about international diplomacy, or whether it's a decision about what you have for breakfast, whether it's the movement of the earth's crust, or whether it's what you choose to do with your pizza crusts after you've eaten your pizza, whether it's a life of personal success or a string of previous failures, none of this falls outside of the purview of God. One day we will see that every single little detail of the whole show is brought about to bring about God's ultimate purposes. All of it is in service to the sovereign King of the universe. Amen.